Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we continue to talk about the world, the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths, with Matthew Fenton, who is a writer and research director of a new book from the editors of Time. It's called Exploring the Unexplained, and it's published by Time Books. And we're very happy to have Matthew Fenton on the telephone with us. Hello, Matthew.
How do you do, sir?
And this book studies the unexplained, subjects that defy our current comprehension of nature and are thus often relegated to the outskirts of mainstream science. I'm curious as to what led to the book, whether it was demand from readers of Time or was this something that was brainstormed, in an editorial meeting?
Well, sir, it was a little bit of both. We did have a sense that this would find an audience among readers, but we also had a lot of journalistic curiosity going in about how much there was there with some of these questions. So there was both a sense that readers wanted to know more and an internal sense that we wanted to know more.
How did you happen to break this book down?
We broke it categorically into a couple of sections. First, there is Mysteries of the Past, where we look at the ancient world. The ancient world we know about or know something about, such as the pyramids, and the ancient world that has mythic status, such as the city of Atlantis. Then we moved on to Mysteries of Nature, such as the putative Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster. Then Mysteries of Space, what's out there. From there, we jump to mind over matter and look at human potential in ways that are only vaguely understood at this moment, such as telepathy and ESP. And finally, penultimately, there is Powers of the Spirit, in which we look at mysteries associated with faith, and then the book closes with A World Beyond, which is focused on the supernatural, essentially, near-death experiences, attempts to contact people in the afterlife, parts of pop culture and folklore that focus on the supernatural, such as vampires, for example.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever concerned that you would not be taken seriously?
We knew that we were serious, so that wasn't much of a concern. A related concern is being skeptical, sometimes cynical, as journalists must be. We were afraid that the book would just become a list of debunked myths and a list of reasons why you shouldn't believe in idea X, idea Y, idea Z. It turned out to be something much more nuanced, something much more interesting and complicated than that, where we were able to find, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, interesting evidence on both sides of the argument. What we have not been able to do, alas, is draw definitive conclusions. We cannot prove that God exists or doesn't exist, that the afterlife exists or doesn't, that sort of thing. But we do find that there are very smart, very talented people around the world doing really interesting work on questions like those and coming up with really interesting evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the frustration, I think, of science and journalists learn to accept this too, is that really important questions are never fully and finally settled. You know, you move the ball down the field a little bit, but you never come to a definitive, or you rarely come to a definitive conclusion that ends the discussion.
Right. And notice the search for truth demands rational guidelines. And so in order to put this together, you've had to look at these stories and issues and myths through a scientific lens.
Yes, sir.
It was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow who said, "It's curious to note the old sea margins of human thought. Each subsiding century reveals some new mystery, and we build where monsters used to hide themselves." And I'm sure you found that true in many of the stories you investigated.
That is very true, and it's a wonderful quote. Another from Arthur C. Clarke is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, at least to the uninitiated. There are many things we take for granted today that 100 years ago would have looked like witchcraft or some sort of sorcery. There may exist things at this moment that are unexplained but not unexplainable, things that we do not yet fully understand, but we will someday.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, there is a human temptation, but it's important to resist, to automatically ascribe to things that are not yet explained some sort of supernatural or non-rational explanation.
Matthew Fenton is our guest. He's the lead writer, research director of a new book from the editors of Time magazine. It's called Exploring the Unexplained. It's published by Time Books. Do you have a website for that?
This does not appear on Time's website, alas. So the book can be purchased or ordered through Time.com, but the content of the book does not appear on the website, alas.
All right. And if people would like to join the conversation to inquire whether or not some interest of theirs is included in the book, some mystery that they've been following or aware of, you can call us in Madison at 263-1890, or it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, the email address is talk@wpr.org. You only have to think back to the deadly Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004, late December, to remind us of the power of nature. And it, I think, would make it a lot easier to understand that something like Atlantis, the lost continent, could have been lost in a situation like that.
I think that's absolutely correct. There are, for example, the city of Troy was absolutely, with complete certainty, known by scholars and scientists all around the world never to have existed and to have been entirely a creation of ancient writers until Heinrich Schliemann went and found Troy in Turkey and proved that, in fact, it was Troy. That may yet happen with Atlantis. Now, on the other side of the scale, it's important to remember that the possibility that such a thing exists is not proof. The fact that it may be out there and we have not discovered it yet doesn't quite amount to evidence that it is there. It is a reason to keep looking, but it is not a reason to draw conclusions.
When you researched this, did you come away with any different conclusions than you had before?
Many, actually. I came away with a new respect for people who are at the very cutting edge, for people who don't care about being respectable or conforming to respectable opinion. We found researchers, for example, at Cornell and Princeton and Duke looking into ESP and doing really, really interesting research. Now, they have not yet proved that things like telepathy exist, although they have found really fascinating indications that it may. But one of the biggest challenges that people like that face is the sort of sneering, eye-rolling disregard that comes from their colleagues. And it's important to remember that there are all sorts of things now that are considered mainstream science that began out there beyond the pale and were ridiculed, you know, for decades, in some cases for centuries, by the purveyors of respectable opinion. So one of the things that we all came away with is a newfound regard for people who have the courage to subject themselves to, at the very least, the skepticism and, in some cases, the cynicism of their colleagues. An example is, not only the folks doing telepathic research at the universities, mm-hmm. but if you look at the serious evidence for something like the Loch Ness Monster. Now, the unfortunate thing is that a lot of what passes for evidence, such as the pictures and movies we have of Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, appear to have been, at best, very dubious, and at worst to have been faked. On the other hand, there is historical evidence that's very, very interesting. That region of Scotland was inhabited by an ancient Celtic tribe called the Picts about 8,000 years ago.
Okay.
They left behind stone carvings of all the animals they knew. Every one of those animals, even though many of them are now extinct, have been identified by paleontologists and scientists, both, you know, contemporary existing species and those that existed then, except for one, which was a giant sea serpent or sea lizard. It bears an interesting resemblance to what we now call the Loch Ness Monster. Is this proof? No. It is interesting, however, that of all the images of animals they left behind, every single one corresponds to an animal that exists now or is known to have existed then, except for this one, and that this one bears such a striking correspondence to the mythic creature that many people believe exists.
And if you watch television right now, you understand that there's a Loch Ness Monster hurling a Toyota Tundra pickup truck out of the lock, out of the Ness.
I have to admit I'm unfamiliar with that.
Oh, you've not seen that commercial?
No, sir, I haven't.
Oh, they've got a Scotsman who's standing next to the Ness, and he's talking about, he's facing the camera with that behind him, and as he's talking about the monster, and the lack of evidence why a pickup truck is actually snatched away from a bank, riverbank or the bank next to the water, and is taken down into the water and then hurled back up on the bank by the monster as he turns around to, you know, amazement.
That sounds like great fun.
What people are now thinking about this Loch Ness Monster.
I would urge people to be more careful in weighing the evidence and drawing conclusions, but that's at the very least testimony to how deeply resonant stories like this are. And Joseph Campbell once said that to ask whether a myth is true is to misunderstand the myth. That's not what myths are supposed to do. There is something mythically powerful about stories like the Loch Ness Monster, and the fact that they seep into every corner and nook and cranny of our popular culture is, I think, evidence of that.
David is in Ironwood, Michigan. David, what's on your mind today?
Does your book have anything about the found out that the universe is actually accelerating apart? I mean, everyone before that was thinking how quickly it was slowing down, and then they took the measurements, and it was actually accelerating.
We've covered that, sir, but not in this book. That is a purely scientific series of measurements that are absolutely fascinating. That's been covered in the weekly issue of Time magazine on several occasions, I think, and also in a previous special issue of Time that looked at amazing scientific discoveries. And you're absolutely right, that is earth-shaking in the sense that it rocks our conception of how the universe is built and what it's doing to its foundation. So it's a very important discovery, but alas, I must acknowledge that it is not covered in this particular book.
Which is an account of the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths. And it's the book called Exploring the Unexplained. It's from the editors of Time. It's published by Time Books. And our guest is Matthew Fenton. And in this first section, we've been talking about mysteries of the past. And you have a picture on page 17 of a French token minted in the year 1680. And it shows a circular flying object.
That is indeed one of a number of palimpsests and artifacts that lend themselves to that sort of explanation. There is on the same page what looks like a gold graven image of an airplane. And these, by the way, occur in cultures around the world, from ancient Egypt, buried with in royal crypts. Archaeologists have found what appear to be airplanes.
Hold that thought, and yes, we'll sir. Come back to it, because we're going to pause to catch up with the latest news from National Public Radio, and then we will come back with Matthew Fenton, and we'll be talking about the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths, including the mysteries of nature, the mysteries of space, mind and matter, powers of the spirit, and a world beyond, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're talking about the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths with the writer and research director of a new book from the editors of Time magazine. It's Exploring the Unexplained, and it's published by Time's Books. And Matthew, again, thank you for spending time with us today.
Glad to, of course.
Just as we broke for the news, you were finishing some thoughts about coins from around the world that seem to prophesy events, spacecraft and things like that, that certainly couldn't have been recognized when they were made.
Well, that's the question. There are folks who look at these things today and believe that they are depicting spacecraft. Now, there are a couple of possibilities here. Number one, always beware the instinct to look through 21st century eyes at something that was made in the 5th century BC or the 1st century, etc. We are bringing the filter of our own culture, our own history, and our own experiences to everything we look at. The next possibility is that even if we are to accept that, for example, the French token that appears in the book that was minted in 1680, if we were to accept that it is depicting what it appears to be depicting, a flying disc in the sky with fire coming out, let's remember that as recently as a week or two ago, a group of people at O'Hare Airport in Chicago saw something, and these include trained pilots, saw something that they were sure was a flying disc with a propulsion system that was ejecting hot gas from the bottom, and it ascended at high speed. The Federal Aviation Administration came and looked at it and said it was almost certainly a strange weather formation. Now, what exists meteorologically today certainly existed 400, 500, and you know, thousands of years ago. So it is possible that these people saw something that we would today call a UFO and that it still wasn't a UFO. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it is entirely possible that they saw something that today we would call a UFO and be unable to ascribe to any other explanation. The frustrating conclusion here with very, very old artifacts that appear to depict UFOs and spacecraft and aircraft is that we can argue, we can interpret, but at the end of the day, we will just never know with certainty what they were seeing and what they were attempting to show us.
If you'd like to join this conversation with Matthew Fenton, all you have to do is pick up the phone in Madison. It's a local call at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. And again, the book is broken down with mysteries of the past, mysteries of nature, mysteries of space, mind and matter, powers of the spirit, and a world beyond. And Joan is next in Dodge County. Hello, Joan.
Why, hi. I'm glad to be on the air.
Yes.
I have several questions that I'd like to give him. But the first one is, does he ever not consider the prophecy that has been shared by generations and generations in all their findings? Doesn't he consider that at all an important link?
Prophecy itself?
Prophecy of this earth.
Well, ma'am, of course, we are very, very careful not to write anything that would disparage or convey disrespect for anybody's religious faith. But the filter or the approach that we're taking in this book was to try and find evidence. And as both scientists and theologians agree, evidence and faith are completely different things. So is that something that we kept in mind in putting the book together? Yes, of course. Is it something, however, that we included in each article saying that the Bible, for example, tells us this about the subject that we're covering on this page? No, we did not, simply because we thought that something that had been done less often before and would be a more valuable service to readers is to weigh the evidence in this world rather than the otherworldly evidence for the questions that we were examining.
Okay, I have another question.
And what would that be, Joan?
Okay. Before you talked about spaceships and things, you know, flying saucers, whatever. Okay, if we here on Earth look out and see this, how can we not know here on Earth what is the real destroyer in our hands around us? How can we not know the difference?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
See if you can clarify.
Okay, we all look up in the heavens, and when all these things happen, the flying saucers and all these things of evidences that whether they're weather balloons or not, we still are so sure that they are flying saucers. I believe, and I know that there is a greater intelligence out there, without a doubt. But at the same time, we are putting our attention on that when the real thing is down here on Earth is we ought to be taking note to what's really destroying civilization here and what are we doing about it.
I think I understand your question now, and the answer is that I believe you're correct as far as you go, but just as people who are neglecting, you know, problems here in the world ought not to be distracted by what appears up in the sky. People who concentrate on what happens all around us here ought not to be neglecting on the world out there that we don't know about. I think an approach to both sets of questions and both sets of problems is best found in terms of balance, that we ought to be doing some of both.
Thanks very much, Joan, for your question and your comment. We've got a couple lines open. If you have a question for Matthew Fenton, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Just looking at the section on powers of the spirit, which her question deals with in some respects. You've got 30-some pages devoted to various myths and legends and mysteries just in the spirit world.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And then there are others questions of mind and matter with Nostradamus and psychokinesis and various things like that. So you have a lot of stories that you're exploring in this book.
Yes, sir. And we did look at questions related to faith quite extensively. What we tried to do, again, however, is take a rigorously evidentiary approach. Now, things we can't find evidence for, of course, we do not dismiss and say are not true. We simply acknowledge that there's a point out there somewhere at which the search for scientific proof ends and the acceptance of faith begins.
Let's go to Jim in Monona. And Jim, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. There's a form of schooling in the United States and Europe that is becoming quite popular. It's called Waldorf schooling, and it's based upon the theosophy of a man named Rudolf Steiner, who claims a form of Rosicrucian theosophy enables people to develop a clairvoyance and the ability to see levels of experience that most of us can't see. Do you know anything about Waldorf schooling and its root in mysticism?
I know only a very little bit, sir, and I have to acknowledge that it is not something that we covered in this book. The more metaphysical aspects of Waldorf philosophy, I think, are generally left out of Waldorf schooling curricula and are left more to philosophers and students of theosophy. At the sort of nuts and bolts level, I believe Waldorf education focuses on letting the child develop at his or her own pace and on placing an emphasis on cooperation between students rather than competition. Does that answer the question? I'm not sure.
No, I'm just generally interested in whether you've looked into Rosicrucianism and this kind of mystical observation of bodies, ethereal bodies, etc.
That is outside the scope of this book, and it is something that I have only the most passing acquaintance with as a layman.
Jim, thanks very much. Sorry we couldn't be of more assistance to you. And let's go to Chris in Green Bay next. Hello, Chris.
Hello. I was just wondering if the guest ever read a book by Dr. Ross. He's a Native American. He wrote a book called We Are All Related, and refers to how many of the Native American myths where man's origin came from and how they're all related as far as internationally. And I was wondering if any of that is in his book.
No, sir, we didn't cover that just because there's such an avalanche of material out there that we had to be, unfortunately, very, very selective in what we included, although it is a fascinating thesis. We mentioned a few minutes ago the scholar of mythology, Joseph Campbell, who spent his life identifying elements in common from myths of every culture. And that is a fascinating subject, which, of course, could be a book unto its own. But, for example, one thing he identified that's very well known is that most cultures include in their creation myths the story of a flood, such as the biblical flood, which is, by the way, not to say that the story of the biblical flood is untrue. It is to say, however, that this is so deeply a resonant theme that when human beings from a variety of cultures around the world have sat down and imagined where they came from, most of them included such a flood story. And, of course, that's one element among many that Campbell identified as being sort of archetypes that appear in culture after culture and myth after myth.
Chris, thank you very much for your call. We're talking with Matthew Fenton, who is a writer and chief research director of the book Exploring the Unexplained. It's published by Times Books. We're talking about the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. And otherwise, it's a toll-free call at 800-642-1234. Dane in Sheboygan is next. What's in your mind today, Dane?
Hi, I'm just calling. I've recently read about artifacts that have been unexplained, one of them being, I think, spherical rocks that depicted people riding on things like triceratops and things like that. And another one was a battery from, I think, in the area of Iraq, and I was just wondering if the guest had any insight into those.
Yes, sir. Actually, the latter artifact that you've mentioned, I believe, is in pop culture called the Baghdad Battery. And it is real, and it appears to date from about 8,000 years ago, and it is nearly impossible to explain. One theory that resonates with other known historical facts is, for example, that the ancient Greeks, around the time of Archimedes, developed what we would now recognize as a steam engine. And yet to them it was only a children's toy. It was basically a sphere mounted on an axle. You would fill the sphere with water, light a fire beneath it, and then there were jets pointing in opposite directions out of two sides of the sphere. When the water boiled, steam would come out, and the sphere would rotate. What they missed about that is stunning, that you could harness that power, and the Industrial Revolution might have happened 3,000 years ago. The Baghdad Battery may be in a similar category. It may have been noticed by, for example, ancient Sumerians, that if you combine certain chemicals in just the right proportion, you could send sparks shooting out of what we would call an electrode, and then they may have gone no further with it. It is a fascinating, if that's the explanation, it's a fascinating dead end to history that could have sparked, which sounds like a pun, although I don't mean it as one, but sparked a great leap forward in human development many thousands of years before it occurred. So yes, sir, that is included in the book, and it is an intriguing and almost unexplainable artifact, but it appears to be a battery. It appears to have worked as a battery when it was built, and we have no idea how they came up with it. And even more compelling and confusing is how they never built on it. Once they had discovered it, how did they never move forward with it? But there are other examples in history like that. For example, the ancient Mexicans, before Europeans arrived, did not have the wheel. They built all these magnificent edifices like pyramids by dragging huge stones, you know, on sleds, but had never developed the wheel. But in the 19th century, archaeologists discovered children's toys in ancient Mexico that did have wheels. So here was the discovery sitting in front of them, staring them in the face, and it never occurred to them that it was any good for anything other than being a toy. And so the Baghdad Battery may be in the same category as the ancient Mexican wheel, as Archimedes' steam engine, a discovery that could have accelerated human history by dozens of centuries and did not, simply because nobody made the leap of imagination to see what else it could be used for.
Dane, thank you very much for that inquiry. And let's go on to Mike in Appleton next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Two questions. Anything in your book on the mysteries of nanotechnology, and anything in your book on Area 51, the government cover-up of UFOs? Thanks.
Yes, sir. The answer to the first question is no, because that's more of a purely scientific area of advance that we have covered in other issues that were about scientific discoveries. The answer to the second question is yes, and Area 51 is a fascinating place. The explanation to it appears to be more down to earth than many folks would like, but it is, I want to say almost certainly, but the almost is inappropriate. It is certainly a highly secret U.S. government test facility at which very, very advanced aircraft are assembled and put through proving runs, you know, trials and field tests. There have been cases dating back to the late 1950s and early 60s where people have identified mysterious lights moving at very high speed and performing maneuvers that airplanes cannot perform. And I think the reason for that is the truth that what the military is doing in secret, it tends to be 25 to 50 years advanced over what the rest of us plain folks know about. For example, stealth technology was highly secret until the late 1970s, early 80s, and remains mostly classified today, but it had existed for almost a decade before that. Going back to Arthur C. Clarke's notion that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, that would be in the magic category until it was revealed that the government was doing this and not only had a reason for doing it, you know, relevant to national security, but also had a reason for keeping it secret. And that appears to be the case with many of the unexplained things related to 51 and also the fact that it is so closely guarded. But we actually spoke to spokesmen for the military who gave us sort of a modified no comment. The military has in the last 5 years or so acknowledged that there is a secret test facility there, but is unwilling to go beyond that.
This is included in your Mysteries of Space section of the book, and those include close encounters at Roswell, unidentified flying objects, and crop circles. What is your latest research findings as far as crop circles?
Again, the answer is interesting but less fun than the notion that aliens from another planet are doing it. Crop circles appear to be, according to the best evidence, a very elaborate prank. Started in the United Kingdom in, I think, the late 70s or early 80s by a group of men who later acknowledged that they were behind all of this, and then spread to people these men had never met all around the world, you know, similarly minded folks. Who figured out that this is not hard to do. The simplest and easiest way, and the way it was done originally, is just to bring a bunch of large wooden planks into a field at night, to sneak into a grain field or a cornfield, and begin laying out very elaborate geometric patterns. It's great fun, especially when it's discovered and people think that the stuff you did last night after the bars closed, you know, was perpetrated by a UFO, but it appears not to have any otherworldly explanation.
All right. Lee in the Cross, let's give you a chance. Hello.
Hi. I was just curious, because a lot of artifacts we find are not exactly out of the public forum. They're easily accessible to a lot of people. I was just curious as to whether or not that, like, correlates with how the myth is like myths are built up.
I think that's a very, very good point. The fact that these are necessarily mostly circulated to a very limited pool of scholars and specialists, not in most cases because there's a conspiracy to lock everybody else out, but the most artifacts reside in a museum somewhere, and then for reasons of conservation and preservation, they generally, the museums and the custodians of those museums, allow only trained personnel to handle them. The next issue that sort of builds on that is if you write a book saying, for example, that the Nazca lines in Peru were petitions from ancient tribes to their gods in the sky begging for rainfall because they were dying as a result of drought, you might get a round of applause from a few hundred scholars around the world who specialize in that and are interested in it. On the other hand, if you write a book saying that the Nazca lines in ancient Peru are actually landing strips for UFOs that visited the Earth 8,000 or 9,000 years ago, the scholars aren't going to give you a round of applause, but you will sell several million or several hundred thousand copies of your book instead of the several dozen or several hundred that you would sell if you were writing to a more serious academic audience. So the disconnect between the limited circle of specialists who spend their lives poring over this kind of material versus the wider audience of folks like us out there is central to the differing perceptions between specialists and everybody else on a wide variety of subjects, including things like the Nazca lines.
Lee, thank you so much for your call, and let's go to Thai and Stevens Point next. Hello.
Hi, I have two questions. The first question is, according to a book called The Mayan Prophecy, it talks about how during the time of the Atlanteans, there was a pole shift that aligned our planets and the solar system that caused a great pole shift that destroyed the world, and these people escaped to ancient Egypt and also the Mayan. That's why they share a similar trait. According to the book, in 2012, it will be the end of the world, according to the Mayan. What's your take on that? And the other question is, another book by Michael Kramer called Human De-Evolution talks about how human used to be highly intelligent but have fallen from grace. And what's your take on that? I'll take my hands off the air.
All right. You got about a minute.
Okay. On the first book about the Mayan prophecy, I have not read the book, but I have some understanding of what's behind it. There are planetary scientists who believe that the Earth's poles have shifted in, I want to say, beyond ancient, pre-ancient history, at a time that was millions of years ago rather than centuries or millennia ago. For any creatures living on the planet at the time, that would have been a cataclysm. It is unclear that human beings were around when this happened, if it happened. So there are some evidentiary holes in the thesis that this happened while the Mayans were a civilization and they predicted it and responded to it before it happened. Nonetheless, it is rooted in some genuine scientific theory. About the thesis of human de-evolution, it is not something we cover in this book. It is a very interesting thesis, but I would argue that it is more theological than historical.
And on that note, we close. And Matthew, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
He's the writer and research director of the book Exploring the Unexplained. It's published by Time Books. They are the world's greatest marvels, mysteries, and myths. Our thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production today. Tomorrow, home renovation and repair issues coming up with Ken Adams of Madison and John Freiberger of Fitchburg. Until then, I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.